homeowners' porches were blown open and little houses were torn up like smokehouses. Most of the roofings were blown off.
Attempts to rebuild after powerful winds tear through Kuskokwim communities. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Port Hyden's road to its harbor is crumbling into the sea.
The road is basically gone. It's cut right half into the road.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The communities of Quinnahock and Platinum are working to rebuild after high winds tore along the coast of Kuskokwim Bay before Christmas. The 85-mile-per-hour winds howled from the southeast on Thursday and Friday, ripping apart buildings but leaving the town's Christmas spirit untouched. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
George Johnson is the public works director for the native village of Quinnahock. He says people are searching the tundra to collect the pieces of their houses and belongings that were lost in the storm.
Homeowners' porches were blown open and little houses were torn up like smokehouses, and most of the roofings were blown off.
The wind flipped boats, destroying their motors. It shattered windows in the tribal office and village health clinic, and it slung a partially constructed house across the road. It just slid on the ice, he said, and they went out and slid it back.
We used a bulldozer, a loader, to drag it across the road.
And they lifted the house back on its pilings. The wind also flipped a 16 by 20 foot fuel warehouse with an employee inside. He came out okay. The damage broke a fuel line, disabling the village's fuel pumps. Workers have rigged a manual system and are limiting gas to 10 gallons per person and stove oil to 5 gallons per person until the problem is fixed. Quinnahock lost power to half the town for a day, but it was restored Saturday evening. The unsettled weather has made Johnson uneasy.
Strange. This weather is getting strange.
Johnson is 65 years old and says the last time he remembers winds of this magnitude was in the 1970s, and he's never seen a December this warm.
It's not even winter yet.
Johnson says the river had just frozen a minor 4 inches before the storm blew away the ice and all the snow. But on Sunday night, that last part changed. About an inch of snow fell, and Quinnahock woke up to a white Christmas. The effect of the storm on the town's already crumbling coastline is unknown. The tribe's natural resource director plans to measure the effects on Thursday. Further down the coast, Platinum also sustained damage. Tribal Administrator Lou Adams says at least 2 fuel tanks were ripped from houses during the storm, strips of roofing were lost, and boats flipped, damaging their steering. 2 power lines were also damaged, leaving the post office with no power and homes with partial power. Adams, who was speaking in front of a Toyo stove, says most of her home has remained without electricity.
My porch and all my outlets, my boiler, my hot water maker, my bathroom, my hall.
Work to restore Platinum's power began today. According to Platinum Power Plant operator Mark Moyle, this is the first time the wind has dropped enough to climb an electric pole since the storm. Despite the storm damage, Christmas in both communities continued as usual. Lights were shining in both Moravian churches, where residents gathered to sing carols, read Bible verses, and exchange gifts. In Quinnahock, residents traveled house to house trading bowls of treats, candy, and a gudeg, or Eskimo ice cream, a mixture of oil, fish, and sugar with berries. George Johnson says at least 20 people treated his family.
Salmon berries, blueberries, red berries, greens from along the beach, excellent agudo.
The third community on Kuskokwim Bay did not sustain damage. City Administrator Karen Evans in Good News Bay says driving on the roads felt dangerous during the storm, but no damage occurred. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Port Hyden is losing shoreline and losing it quickly. Wind and waves have eroded the coast by an average of about 30 feet this year. Areas along the road from Port Hyden to their old village site lost roughly 17 feet just in November. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
The road winds along the edge of a 12-foot bluff above the beach. Goldfish Lake hems in the road from the other side. The shoreline of the ocean is about 45 feet away from the lake, and the water from the lake is already steadily seeping through that bluff. With the road crumbling on the one side and Goldfish Lake about to breach on the other, the village closed the road at the end of last month.
The road is basically gone. It's cut right half into the road.
That's Scott Anderson. He's the tribal environmental director with the native village of Port Hyden. He says it's not clear now precisely how the landscape will look when the lake does breach, but it's open to speculation.
I figure once it breaks through the water that runs into the lake from the watershed, it's going to make a large river and it's going to drain out.
Losing the road means losing access to the safe harbor, a protected lagoon down the road. Instead, the village will have to launch their boats into the bay from the beach much closer to the village.
Trying to offload our boats off the on the bay side here with no protection, with no harbor, it's pretty rough on the boats. Every year we have some kind of a incident where, you know, we're spending thousands of dollars repairing our boats. So it's significant for us.
The road closure also means that no one can drive into the old village site. It was abandoned due to encroaching erosion by 2008. The village has cleaned up many of the old buildings in order to keep them from becoming debris in the ocean and on the beaches. They're hoping to temporarily reestablish access to the village site from the beach once Goldfish Lake breaches so that they can finish removing the handful of remaining buildings. Anderson anticipates that the lake will breach this winter based on the recent rate of erosion. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
This week, the Italian company Eni began the initial drilling of an exploratory oil well in the Beaufort Sea west of Prudhoe Bay. It's the first oil exploration project to take place in Arctic federal waters since Shell discontinued their efforts in 2015. The movement on the project comes after Eni passed a pre-drill inspection earlier this month, conducted by the Federal Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement. Two of the Bureau's personnel were present for the initial drilling to ensure compliance with permits and regulations, and inspectors from the agency will continue to make visits to the site throughout the drilling phase, which they anticipate to last most of the winter. There's currently a second drilling project proposed in the Beaufort, this one by the Texas-based company Hillcorp. Known as the Liberty Project, it's a drilling and production facility that Hillcorp says could increase the amount of oil going through the Trans-Alaska pipeline by 70,000 barrels per day. The federal government has begun preparing the final environmental impact statement for that project. For the last 5 years, Southeast's iconic king salmon have been returning in fewer and fewer numbers. Managers with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are recommending Chilkat, Yunik, and King Salmon River Chinooks become official stocks of concern. Conservation management is advised for the rest of the Southeast king salmon. KHNS's Barrett Wilbur reports.
Next year, biologists are predicting the smallest number ever of Chinook salmon returning to the Chilkat River.
You know, I've been studying Chinook on this river for 20 years. It's very painful to watch this happen.
That's Brian Elliott, who monitors Chinook stocks for Fish and Game in Haines. The department is recommending Chilkat Chinook for a stock of concern designation. Kings from the Yunik and King Salmon Rivers will also likely get the title, and new management plans that will restrict harvest. The Board of Fish is set to approve Chilkat Chinooks as a stock of concern at their January meeting after years of some of the lowest returns they've ever seen. Last year, only 1,173 kings were forecasted to spawn up the river. That's between 1 and 2/3 less than managers hoped for.
It was the lowest escape and estimate since we've been conducting this kind of research. This is a region-wide effect. It's not specific to Chilkat. It's not specific to northern southeast. This is a sweeping problem.
The escapement goal represents the number of fish that need to spawn to guarantee there are enough baby fish for healthy and harvestable runs. And that's not happening.
Just generally in Southeast, the department monitors 11 Chinook stocks for escapement, and we only had 2 reach the lower bound of their escapement goals. 2 out of 11.
Next year's forecast is even worse. Just 1,033 kings are expected to run up the Chilcat. Elliot worries that if those numbers keep dipping, Southeast's king salmon won't stop dwindling even if fishing is completely restricted.
Despite restrictive actions in all of our fisheries, we've really pulled back the reins on harvest and we're still not making our escapement goals. That tells us this is a production problem, this is a survival problem.
Ed Jones agrees. He's Fish and Game's Chinook Research Initiative coordinator. He says baby king salmon are suffering from marine mortality.
They're just dying when they go into the ocean. From Southeast all the way to the Yukon, this mortality is occurring in their first few months at sea. We surmise that it's probably something to do with water temperature and food, but say we found out the water was too warm, it's not like we're going to be able to cool the water off.
Managers can't jump in the water and guard fish. They can only adjust the behavior of people, he says. Giving Chinooks stock of concern status will give the department new guidelines to enforce who can fish when. ADF&G's draft action plan includes a scale of lenient to stringent restrictions for each fishery that's likely to see kings from the Chilcat, Yunik, or King Salmon River. Options include restrictions by gear, such as limiting mesh sizes for gillnetters, to closing fishing areas, postponing or shortening seasons, and ratcheting down bag limits. In January, the Board of Fish will choose which level of restriction to run with for each fishery, commercial, sport, and subsistence. They can mix, match, add, or reject elements of the draft plan, meaning new rules for catching Southeast Chinook won't be final until the meeting is over. The board will take public comment as part of their deliberation. Last year, sport, commercial, and subsistence fisheries on the Chilcat all operated under restrictions until the department embargoed catching kings in late August. Elliot says fishermen should expect more restrictions in 2018.
When we're in this kind of low abundance level, every fish does matter. So we're going to try to reduce harvest to an absolute minimum in all fisheries.
Jones echoes those concerns. He says, while it's typical to see salmon cycle through better and worse runs, these numbers are not normal, or at least they didn't used to be.
The cycles are increasing in amplitude. What we're seeing today is the peaks and valleys are extremely dramatic, unprecedented, either unprecedented bad times or unprecedented good times. We haven't seen the good time yet.
The Board of Fish will meet January 11th through 23rd in Sitka. In Haines, I'm Barrett Wilbur.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state cleans up the derelict vessel Accutan.
We've removed all of the petroleum-based products, as well as any other sort of hazardous materials that were on board.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Thanks for listening today. We love being a part of your media mix. Tune in every day to catch the best in statewide news and programming.
On Alaska, we'll have a mayoral recall election early next year after a successful petition was submitted to city government. After being told there were not enough valid signatures on Thursday, petitioners collected 17 more and submitted them to the city clerk's office yesterday. City Clerk Margie Veder certified the petition with 172 valid signatures. A KUCB public records request shows this includes numerous city employees, as well as the heads of multiple city departments, including public safety, parks, culture and recreation, ports and harbors, and the human resources manager. The petition seeks to recall Mayor Frank Kelty, alleging misconduct in office. Kelty says he will not appeal the decision. In an email, he says, quote, "I will just campaign against the allegation, which is very weak in my estimation," end quote. The date for the recall election will be set at the first city council meeting of 2018. It must be held between February 23rd and March 26th. After months sitting abandoned in Unalaska, the state announced last week its intention to dispose of the fishing vessel Accutane. The processor was abandoned in Unalaska's Captain's Bay in September following a disastrous fishing season in Bristol Bay, where the ship's owner went broke, the crew went unpaid, and its 158,000-pound haul of salmon was declared unfit for human consumption. The state is looking for buyers interested in the vessel. If there are two or more prospective buyers, they will conduct a public auction, or the Accutane will be donated for scrap or destroyed. The U.S. Coast Guard has removed all environmental threats from the fishing vessel. Chief Marine Science Technician Nathan Hatfield monitored the removal.
We've removed all of the petroleum-based products, as well as any other sort of hazardous materials that were on board.
Hatfield says that includes portable chlorine tanks, lead batteries, and ammonia from a refrigeration system. An ordinance requiring buffers around eagle nests may soon be removed from Juneau's land use code. To locate the nests, city enforcers rely on federal biologists, but years of federal cuts have made them scarce. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
The current rules bar development within 50 feet of an eagle's nest. That increases to 330 feet during the six-month nesting season and extends to 350 feet for nests on public land. But Terry Camry, a senior city planner, says identifying nests has become harder.
We're having increasingly more difficulty identifying where the nests were. Sometimes we would know, sometimes we didn't, and so we were enforcing it so inconsistently based on whether we had information about a nest or whether we didn't.
Biologists with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have long helped the city find and plot eagle nests. But as the eagle population increases, it's the biologists who have been dropping off.
A few years ago, we had over 20 people here in Southeast Alaska in the Juneau office. These days, we have about five.
Steve Brockman is Southeast Alaska Coordinator for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Our staff declines have been a direct result of budget tightening at the national level.
In Juneau, that means there's only one raptor expert left, and he's responsible for all of Alaska. The Trump administration's proposed budget continues the cutting trend, including shedding 324 full-time jobs across the agency. So with the city staff basically flying blind, Camry says it's not good policy to keep the ordinance.
The key issue is enforcement. We can't enforce an ordinance if we don't have the basic information on where the eagle nest is.
It's not the first time the city's proposed eliminating its eagle buffers. The Planning Commission was against a similar effort about 5 years ago. The Assembly heard public outcry, and it stalled in 2012. But the Planning Commission's composition has since changed. It unanimously backed it in August. The Assembly will have a public hearing and likely vote at next month's meeting. Even if the Assembly scraps eagle buffers, the birds remain protected under federal law. An act of Congress 77 years ago makes it a crime to disturb eagles, their nests, or eggs without a federal permit. Brockman notes that bald eagles were never threatened or endangered in Alaska.
We do have really an awesome eagle population in Southeast Alaska. It's one of the most dense and largest nesting populations anywhere on planet Earth, and we're proud of that. Part of the reason is because there's been effective management, including the constraints on development around eagle nests that you see in the Juneau area.
In anticipation of the rule change, the city's permit department is working on pamphlets to encourage voluntary measures to protect eagles. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. Education scholarships and grants for ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, are available. To learn where the possibilities this education can take you, visit beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. Energy lives here.
Thank you. For half a century, the Sheldon Mountain House has stood above the Ruth Glacier as a shelter and gathering place. Now it has a new neighbor in the form of a luxury accommodation just a few hundred feet away. KTNA's Philip Manning visited the new Sheldon Chalet and has this story.
The Don Sheldon Amphitheater on the Ruth Glacier is one of the most striking vistas in the Alaska Range. In the midst of miles of mountain and ice, in the amphitheater sits a small structure that's been there since the 1960s. Over the years, hundreds have taken shelter inside what's become known as the Mountain House. The building sits on a nunatak, an outcropping of rock surrounded by ice and snow. Now, a second, larger building stands on the nunatak as well, the Sheldon Chalet. The chalet is the result of 3 years of work by members of the Sheldon family. Robert Sheldon shows me inside.
Headed inside. Got a big glass door here from our listening audience. It's super insulated, though, even though it is glass.
Where the old mountain house is basic and rugged in its accommodations, the Sheldon Chalet is the epitome of luxury. Arriving guests are treated to a lunch that can feature items including halibut, oysters, and Alaska king crab. Robert Sheldon's wife, Marnie, says guests of the chalet will likely be looking for the most Alaskan experience possible, so it only makes sense to take advantage of what the state has to offer.
Alaska seafood is amazing, right? So why would we have an experience without that? So that's why we're holding to that element. And not only the seafood, but, you know, the beer and our beverages and everything from Denali Brewing that we can source from them. Keeping it local, keeping it authentic. Because when people come to Alaska, that's what they're looking for.
The food is far from what one would normally expect to eat while staying on a glacier, and the quality of accommodations and amenities are comparable to what one would find in a luxury hotel anywhere else in the world. An inevitable part of any overnight stay in the wilderness, and particularly in the mountains, is what happens when nature calls. Marnie says guests at the Sheldon Chalet will be using bathrooms that will feature almost all of the familiar fixtures.
Then we have an incinerating toilet, which requires no water, kind of the eco-friendly way of having nicer than a CMC can, because so far that's all that's existed up here.
While the building, its surroundings, and its accommodations are beautiful, safety has to be considered as well. After all, the chalet sits at nearly 6,000 feet of elevation in a mountain range and near a significant fault line. Robert Sheldon says the building is very firmly attached to the nunatak on which it sits.
Our base that we could build off of is super, super stable to begin with. And so our seismicity is the highest rating that you can receive for our structure. We also built the building with a number of components where we made sure we anchored in really well.
In addition, Robert Sheldon says the chalet was engineered to withstand the winds of a Category 5 hurricane for 2 days, though he adds that sustained winds in the area have only been observed at less than half that speed. As with anything related to flying in and out of the Alaska Range, weather is an important consideration. The plan is for guests to generally spend 3 or 4 days at the chalet. But what happens when the weather prevents flights in and out? Robert Sheldon says delays are likely to be minimal, and chalet guests could use the opportunity to spend time in Talkeetna.
Any given day, you got a 60% plus chance of getting in, unless it's helicopter, it's well into the 80s. Mm-hmm. And so you might have a day delay. So to pivot off of Talkeetna is to utilize the Historical Society, go through the museum, to go to some of the shops. Maybe they take a boat ride.
In fact, Robert says he hopes the tourism business the chalet attracts will have carryover effects into Talkeetna, with people either spending a day or two in and around town. He says where Alaska tourism has lacked is in targeting the high-end market. That's something he and the other investors in the chalet plan to address.
This is the crown jewel, though. This place is to focus effort on Denali, and it is probably as high-end as you're going to receive in Alaska.
The price tag for a stay at the Sheldon Chalet bears out the plan to target the high-end tourism market, with a night costing over $2,000 per pillow. The Sheldon Chalet is slated to open for business later this winter. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
A recent memoir chronicles the adventures of a young man as he emigrated from Ireland to New York and Alaska. The Way It Was is based on the writings of Malachy Donahue and was published after his death. His son Michael says he realizes his father's story was more than a collection of family memories. It was a story of hard work and success that he wanted to share. Malachy Donahue was born in 1927 in a small Irish farming community, but he had to grow up fast when his father died of an aneurysm. Malachy was only 11. And had to be the man of the house, helping his mother run their farm. He left for New York at age 22, but found the city's temperatures too hot. So with no knowledge of California, he decided to move to San Diego in 1950. But his son Michael says when he got to Seattle, he bailed off the plane.
And suddenly said, I want to go somewhere where it's cold. Had no idea anything in America. Really had no idea where he was even. And they said, we have two flights going to Alaska. And my father said, which one is the first one? And they said, to Fairbanks. And that's where he jumped on a plane and went to Fairbanks.
Once in Fairbanks, he had no idea where to go. So he sat on a bench and struck up a conversation with a stranger.
This man ended up being like his saving grace. He pointed him in the right direction, got him a job at the Gold Stream camp, you know, gold camp. And he then went on to the El Dorado camp.
Eventually, the company he worked for sent him to the Koyukuk River to locate a gold mine they hadn't seen since 1939. He found it and ran the camp there for years. One day, he once again ran into the man who helped him get his first job in Alaska.
This man got him into the engineers union there, and that's how he eventually became an engineer. My father was such a hard worker, so anywhere he went, people wanted him to work for them. He didn't worry about jobs. They just always came to him for it.
The elder Donahue eventually made his way back to New York and married a young woman who had been his pen pal during his years in Alaska. His son Michael says Alaska was always in his father's heart and contends he would have stayed in the North if he hadn't fallen in love with his writing companion. The book, The Way It Was, is available on Amazon. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. We had reports tonight from Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Ravina Koenig in Fairbanks, Barrett Wilbur in Haines, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.